In our final case today, Caldwell versus Whirlpool, 2023-08-09. This morning, we welcome to the bench Judge Michael Mental of the 10th District Court of Appeal, who is sitting in place of Justice Melody Stewart. Thank you, Judge, for agreeing to serve.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Pleasure to be here.
On behalf of the appellants, Ms. Rubin, it seems that you are sharing time with the state. Is that correct?
Yes, Chief Justice.
And I have written here that you are going to speak for 7 minutes. The state's going to speak for eight. There's no reservation of rebuttal, or you're going to reserve some of your 7 minutes for rebuttal.
6 minutes, Your Honor, and then I will speak 7, and then we will have 2 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Thank you. You may proceed. Mr. Geiser or Gazer?
It's Geiser. Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Elliot Geiser for the Bureau of Workers' Compensation. I want to make 2 points today in support of reversal. First, the Third District's conclusion that a timely filed additional conditions claim on appeal in the Court of Common Pleas can be cut off by operation of the administrative review statute. It is not supported in the text of 412352A, nor are we aware of any analogical construction of a similar statute of limitations. Second, if this court harbors any doubt about the text of the administrative review process, then context, constitutional avoidance, and consequences all point in the same direction, that the General Assembly did not throw injured workers and courts hearing timely filed appeals into a race with an arbitrary hourglass in the sky that can cut off their claims in midstream. I would like to begin now speaking of the text of the administrative review process. That sets a 5-year limit on bringing additional conditions claims. And as this court said in Romans versus Elder Bierman,
let me ask you this. So if an additional condition is allowed, then what does the Industrial Commission have to do?
Well, if the Industrial Commission decides—
In order for someone to get paid.
Well, then the claimant has to file the necessary medical bills, receipts, if it's allowed for participation for that additional condition.
Well, so I guess that's where I get a little hung up. So I understand the argument and makes that, well, this doesn't cut off permission. This doesn't cut off the ability to continue your lawsuit to participate in the fund. But it's the next step, I think, where it gets a little tricky. We have this language that no modification or change nor any finding or award in respect of any claim shall be made after 5 years. So how is that subsequent filing to get paid once the additional condition has been allowed, how is that not cut off by this?
Well, I would turn, Your Honor, to look at 511 and 512. Those also have language about what the Industrial Commission shall do once you have a claim that's allowed or an additional commission claim that's filed. And then the Romans case, which talks about how the operation of 52A, the administrative review process, is designed to cut off claims after a period of inactivity. Once a claimant has filed a claim for an additional condition, we're no longer in that period of inactivity. And so to construe that shall be made language that Your Honor quoted as limiting review once you're in the courts under 512A is not supported by the text. The context of 52A is all before the administrative process. And so the only statutory timeline that's applicable to an appeal is the 60-day notice of appeal in 512A. And then that statute makes clear that a notice of appeal is all that is necessary to perfect the appeal. So it would be unusual to sort of nest 52A, 511, and 512 like Russian nesting dolls all within that 5-year period when the relationship between those statutes is a transfer of authority to the scheme that the General Assembly created. So once you file within 52A, now you're in the 511 administrative review process. And once that process is completed, either the employer or the worker then has a 60-day period in the 512 process. And so looking at those three statutes together and reading that context shows that that language that the third district construed in a vacuum doesn't mean what the third district said it means. I'd also like to turn to the consequences of the third district's conclusion. The legislature in revised code 149E makes clear that courts should consider as one of the tools of statutory construction those consequences. There is no time at which an additional conditions claimant can file within that 5-year period and be ensured that they will get all of the review to which the statute otherwise would entitle them. This court alone often takes a year for review. It's been 2 years since the third district issued its decision here. And so litigants will have to post on the top of their briefs, must have a decision by June 23, 2027, and be seeking expedition at every single level of review. And that can't be what the legislature intended to do by the 5-year period of limitations in the administrative process. And there are no other statutes of limitations that operate this way of which we are aware, and appellees have pointed to none. It seems highly unusual that a statute that a claimant can do basically everything right and then conditions outside their control, to use the language of this court's opinion in 2200 Carnegie, can then cut off the review. And this leads to constitutional avoidance as another tool of statutory construction, where the due process concerns in placing a litigant's opportunity to review outside of their control, in the control of the administrative and then the court process, and then ultimately in the hands of their adversaries who have every incentive already to foot drag. The grand bargain of the workers' compensation scheme, its unique creature of statute, would be disrupted by interpreting the statute as the third district did here. I would also offer to the court a concern about the just and reasonableness of under revised code 1.47. A just and reasonable result is intended, and it seems highly arbitrary that, like Mr. Caldwell did here, he can file at year 3.5 and he did not receive a favorable outcome in front of the Industrial Commission, and then did everything right in terms of what his statutory review process would involve, only to find that his claim was cut off later. I want to be sure that I leave some time for rebuttal and also ample time to Mr. Caldwell's counsel.
Thank you. Ms. Rubin.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court. My name is Chelsea Rubin. I represent Brian Caldwell in this case. It is undisputed that my client filed his motion for additional conditions within 5 years of 4123.52. It's also undisputed that he filed his notice of appeal under 4123.512 within 60 days. That alone perfects his appeal in a court of common pleas. Therefore, there is really no issue in this case and no basis for the court of appeals, or excuse me, the court of common pleas to dismiss it on a motion for summary judgment. This court has made clear that a continuing jurisdiction issue under 412352 has to be decided by the commission first. In this case, that issue was never heard by the commission because it was never an issue. And that's because he filed that motion for additional conditions well within that 5-year statute of limitations. This court has also made clear that a court of common pleas only has jurisdiction on the specific conditions that have already been adjudicated by the Industrial Commission. And under 4123.512b, a notice of appeal has to have the party's names, the claim number, as well as the conditions that are being disputed. Here, the only conditions that were filed in that notice of appeal were low back conditions. So therefore, the Court of Common Pleas lacked jurisdiction to even consider this continuing jurisdiction issue of the Industrial Commission. Last, it's important to understand that this court has made clear that it is superfluous and unnecessary to request compensation or medical bills before additional conditions are allowed in an administrative claim. And so my client could not have asked for those compensation and medical bills before he was able to have his day in court and prove his right to participate for those additional conditions. Unfortunately, he never had his day in court because the Court of Common Pleas arbitrarily granted a motion for summary judgment based upon 4123.52. a statute that only applies to the Industrial Commission. And the Industrial Commission is the only body that should decide if it has jurisdiction over an administrative claim before a court of common pleas can decide that issue. If there are no other questions, I'll reserve the rest of our time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Barnes.
Justice Kennedy, may it please the court. This is interesting. What's been lost in this entire appeal is that the claimant did not do everything right. This claimant filed a 512 appeal, obviously about 3 years into the remaining, or maybe two years remaining in the life of the claim. A trial court scheduled a trial. Trial was set. And the claimant voluntarily dismissed. Voluntary dismissal obviously means it was by his own accord. Now this court—
Whatever rule we write today is going to apply in all cases, right? It's going to apply yes. Whether someone's been voluntarily dismissed or not, right?
That is true.
So—
That is true.
So what's the significance then of the voluntary dismissal here?
I would point out to the court that this is not, it's been argued to the court that the claimant did everything right and somehow this statute's being applied to deprive him of due process. The claimant had a right to try his case. His due process rights were not abrogated, contravened by what the court did when it ultimately decided summary judgment several months thereafter. He had the opportunity to go forward. He chose not to go forward. He then invoked the saving statute. The saving statute doesn't require that you wait a year before you refile your claim. And this court has said on more than one occasion, and
I guess I'm still trying to understand, when we write the opinion in this case, is the saving statute, is that relevant somehow here?
Saving statute has no
probably
relevance.
Is the fact that he or she refiled their claim, is that a determinative factor in this case?
No.
So it doesn't matter.
What's determinative in this case is the application of the language of 4123.52.
Okay, so this doesn't really matter whether or not they refiled or not.
It really does not matter.
Okay.
The claim.
So why are we talking about it?
Exactly.
if you're
asking for my opinion on whether or not this matter should even be before the Supreme Court, my opinion would be that it should not be. This is a matter that is personal to Mr. Caldwell. It is not a matter of general or great public interest. This is a matter that's personal to Mr. Caldwell. He failed to avail himself of his rights. He had every opportunity to have this matter resolved and then attempt to get compensation and medical benefits paid before his claim expired.
Didn't the third district in effect say that the trial court lost jurisdiction because of the passage of time?
No.
Statute that applied only to the Bureau of Workers' Compensation and never mentioned the Common Pleas Court?
I don't believe the Third District said that at all. In fact, I believe the Third District said that the issue of, I don't think the issue of jurisdiction was even relevant to their opinion.
Well, if something is brought too late, whether it's statute of limitations, statute of repose, doesn't it really boil down to that the court can't hear it?
No. This is a matter, Your Honor, of a dispositive issue which regards the one of the primary elements of the claim, okay? And as this court has announced on more than one occasion, and I think that we cited the Bennett Court for this proposition of law, the claimant has the burden of proving each and every element of their claim on a 512 appeal as a de novo appeal. One of those elements of the claim is the existence and the life of the claim, whether or not it's viable. Now, at some point, and in this particular case, the claim became not viable. By operation of law, after the 5 years had passed since the payment of compensation or medical benefits, which is set forth in the statute, the claim died. Now, at that point, obviously, the claim had not been refiled back into the trial court. Once it was refiled in the trial court, Whirlpool raised the issue for the trial court and filed the dispositive motion, counsel, arguing that this claim has died by operation of law. Just like any other dispositive issue that a trial court's going to have, it's not a matter of jurisdiction. It's a question of whether or not there is an element of this claim that the claimant cannot prove. It would be no different, well, Your Honor, if the claimant failed to have evidence on causation, and that was raised during the trial court proceedings, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We've talked about both your colleagues and now you've mentioned 412352. I look at the first sentence of subsection A, the jurisdiction of the Industrial Commission. Then the rest of that section proceeds.
Right.
I also look at what this court has said in Yohemene v. Mansfield. And essentially that the court is saying, once that claim is filed, then jurisdiction lies with that appellate body. In addition to that, now you're looking at also the statutory construction issues, well, not statutory construction, but interpretation, that 412352A says that to perfect the appeal, and uses the word perfect, how then when you look at the 5-year limitation and jurisdiction, even by the interpretation of the decision of this court, says that the matter is now within the full jurisdiction and is perfected with the appellate court, how doesn't that behoove us to look at this as in terms of this being within the realm of the administrative procedures of the commission, since all of the jurisdiction is now vested in the appellate court?
Your Honor, as Whirlpool explained in his brief, all of the jurisdiction is not vested with the trial court. There is concurrent jurisdiction, always has been, between the Industrial Commission of Ohio and the trial court, even on a 512 appeal. What the court has jurisdiction over is the allowance question. Okay, so when you appeal an issue into court, here it's a low back condition. The trial court takes jurisdiction over that condition to the extent that whether it should be allowed or disallowed. If that claim had been allowed for that particular condition and the employer appealed, the trial court has jurisdiction, obviously, over the appeal and the allowance question.
Well, court,
however,
counsel, wouldn't you?
Administratively, Your Honor, administratively, the Industrial Commission would also have jurisdiction over that condition as compensation and benefits continue to be paid while that condition is being litigated in the trial court.
I agree with you. I agree with you making your contention in terms of what you're contending. I comprehend that. My question to you, though, is where is it explicit? The court did not make this court in Mansfield did not make that explicit. It said vest, period. The statute says once the appeal is made, it's perfected. Where in does this now jive where there's a split? Is this not either 100% on the appellate court side, or is it not?
It's not a jurisdictional question, Your Honor, and the Third District did not decide this on a jurisdictional basis.
The time was clicking on the five-year limitation, correct?
Where the third
appeal is made 2 year or 2.5 years within that 5-year period. Now, who has all of the jurisdiction? What do the cases and the statute say?
As far as jurisdiction over the appeal question and the additional allowance, it's clearly the trial court that has jurisdiction over that issue. The Industrial Commission retains jurisdiction over the claim, and every additional condition is embodied in the claim. And so when you look at 4123.52, which talks about the Industrial Commission's continuing jurisdiction, and the limitations period for that statute has been in effect since 1931.
But it's never been interpreted the way you're asserting. It's never been interpreted as a cap.
Oh, no, I would say that's not true, Your Honor. I'd say that this Supreme Court has found that it is a cap, if you want to call it a cap. It is a statute of limitations on the life of a claim.
That has also a limitation on the appellate courts?
The courts have not stated that. The courts have not had to state that it somehow limits the trial court, but it doesn't limit the trial court. What the trial court did and what the Court of Appeals did was they looked at the Bennett decision of this court. Bennett talks about how when you are on a 512 appeal, each and every element of the claim is still at issue. One of the issues that remains viable is the life of the claim. If you don't have a claim, then you can't carry your burden of proof that you have the right to participate in the system for that additional condition. By logical extension, let's assume, Your Honor, for the sake of argument, that this matter went to a trial. It goes to a trial. Let's assume for the sake of argument that the claimant wins. Now the claimant has a judicial order saying, you have the right to participate for this particular condition. Under 4123.512G, those decisions are subject to the power to modify by the Industrial Commission, so it toggles back to 52. You have an expired claim. You take this decision back to the commission, and the claimant says, now give me some benefits. I'd like to file a motion for compensation. At that point, the commission cannot do anything. The claim has expired. It is dead by operation of law. There's nothing in the statute, absolutely nothing in .52 that says that the Industrial Commission has to make that determination. There's nothing in 52 that says an employer has to file a motion with the Industrial Commission to get a ruling on its continuing jurisdiction. The way the statute is written, it is self-effective by operation of law. This is how the courts of appeals in this state have interpreted it. The Perez Court, Cochurl, Williams, the Third District twice. This court has announced claims lapse. You can choose whatever language you like. It lapses, dead by operation of law, fatally inactive. But there is a purpose that the General Assembly had in mind when it wrote what is now 4123.52. The statute has been in effect since 1911. And that purpose is these claims have a life. That's what happened in 1931 when the limitations period was put on. They have a life. They're not going to exist in perpetuity. There has to be a tolling event in order to stop that statute from running. And this court has announced that the onus is on the claimant to do that. The claimant has the responsibility to ensure that the statute does not run. And it's not a foot race, as has been argued by counsel. It is not a foot race. There's obviously a time limitation. However, you know, a foot race suggests that maybe counsel, either for the claimant or for the employer, engage in some sort of gamesmanship to try to game the system. Well, whenever you have an administrative system, there's going to be gamesmanship. That's how life works. However, claimants know, and they should know, what's been paid in their claim. They know or should know when the claim is going to expire. There are no secrets here. Even with a self-insured employer, self-insured employers are required to provide claim information to the claimants or their counsel upon request. And so in a situation like this, when the claim was appealed to the trial court, the onus was on Mr. Caldwell to figure it out, to get his claim allowed and then get compensation paid. It's not the filing of a request for compensation. It's not the filing of a request for an additional condition that's going to toll the statute. That's not in the statute. It's the payment of compensation or medical benefits. Those are the tolling elements in 4123.52. And I would also argue, Your Honor, that this is not a matter of statutory construction, as counsel has argued to the court. There's been no allegation that this statute is ambiguous. My understanding of statutory construction is when you have a statute that's clear and unambiguous, it gets applied. And that's what the Third District did. That's what the Cultural Court talked about. We have a clear statute. We have to follow the statutory mandate. That mandate is claims expire within a certain time frame. So this court does not need to engage in statutory interpretation. That occurs only when the statute has been called into question. Mr. Caldwell, at no point during this case, either in the trial court or the Court of Appeals or even in this court, has called into question the language of 4123.52 and made an allegation that it was somehow unconstitutional. What Mr. Caldwell did is he raised an issue about due process because the way this got applied, somehow he could not get his case resolved before it expired. That's not a question on the statute's constitutionality or its interpretation. I see that I'm out of time. Unless someone has a question for me, I will take my seat. Thank you.
You have 6 minutes, 28 seconds in rebuttal. The state's going to do it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Just two quick points on rebuttal. The first is the question of what to do with silence in the statute. And I was appreciative of my friend on the other side making the point that the administrative review statute is silent as to the jurisdiction of courts. The burden to seek a result that would be unusual under the Anglo-American legal tradition, especially when the General Assembly in 4123.95 urged a liberal construction in favor of workers, would be on the appellee to show where it is explicit in the statute to override those background principles. And the statute just simply is silent on that point. And so we think that's all this court needs to do in order to reverse. Second, with respect to the consequences, my friend on the other side talked a little bit about trial and the fact that an appeal here does operate in the Court of Common Pleas and can include a jury trial. Point 512G makes clear that if the finding is by the court or by the jury, then it operates as if it's the finding of the Industrial Commission in the event that the claimant prevails. Well, think about a situation like the COVID crisis that we dealt with over the last several years, where trials sometimes have continuances. There would be no time at which you can file within that five-year period if that clock keeps running, where you could be assured that you'd actually get that trial done. It could be day three of the trial when that five-year mark is hit, and that would cut off review. That would be a highly unusual consequence, and one that would, I think, lead to a cornucopia of pro se unda motions in motions to expedite, and I don't think that's any way to run a railroad. If there are no further questions, we urge reversal. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You will receive a decision from the court. Marshall, would you close the court, please?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.